This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger with help from Bronwyn Bleakley at the University of Exeter, England. I'm Don Glass.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. It is a production of Illinois Public Media on WILL AM 580. It's baseball interleague weekend with St. Louis Cardinals hosting Kansas City and the White Sox at home versus Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, the Cubs are in San Diego to take on the Padres in the only major league series pitting two teams from the same league. Round two, by the way, of the PGA Tour's Byron Nelson Classic is underway in Texas. Ken Duke and James Nitti started the day sharing a one-stroke lead over a group of four golfers after carding a 5-under par 65s in the opening round. And the draw of the French Open was released today, and top-ranked Rafael Nadal will begin his quest to become the first man to win five straight titles at Roland Garros against a qualifier who has yet to be determined. Sisters Venus and Serena Williams have been drawn into opposite sides of the field and can only meet in the women's final. Play begins Sunday in Paris. And finally, the son of a New York City assistant principal who died of H1N1, has pitched a no-hitter while wearing a cap bearing his father's initials. Jordan Wiener is the son of Mitchell Wiener, an assistant principal at an intermediate school in Queens. Jordan attends Robert F. Kennedy High School in Queens and struck out 14 batters on Thursday. His father was buried Wednesday after dying of the virus on Sunday. The 18-year-old senior says he felt his father giving him the power to win. He says his dad would want him to do what he does best, and that is pitching.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
Well, members of Congress took a big step toward forcing a change in the way we use energy. A House committee approved a bill as thick as a history book. It's designed to battle climate change and would instruct industries to sharply reduce their greenhouse gas pollution over time. The bill promotes wind and solar power, and companies like electrical utilities would have to get more creative or pay a higher and higher price for the right to pollute. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports.
It was a grueling four-day debate with 94 amendments considered and sessions lasting until midnight. House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Henry Waxman from California managed the debate.
When this bill is enacted into law, we'll break our dependence on foreign oil, make our nation the world leader in clean energy jobs and technology, and cut global warming pollution.
Republicans offered one amendment after another to dilute the bill. Most were rejected. They wanted provisions to cancel the bill if industries moved abroad or electric bills got too expensive. John Shimkus from Southern Illinois showed a photo of coal miners whose jobs, he said, would be in jeopardy because the bill would make burning coal too expensive.
This amendment says if these guys get screwed, we're going to have an off-ramp to protect jobs.
The House bill would create what's called a cap-and-trade program. This is how it would work. The government would set a cap or limit on pollution and tighten it over time. The government would also create a market where companies would buy and sell the right to pollute. Companies would need what's called an allowance for every ton of carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gas they emit. Jeff Sterba is the CEO of PNM Electric Company in New Mexico and Texas.
If you can reduce your carbon use for less than the going price of carbon, you're going to do that, and then you'll sell allowances.
Companies that had a harder time cutting emissions would buy those allowances.
So the marketplace finds the cheapest way to get the job done.
That's David Doniger from the environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council. During President Obama's campaign, he said he wanted to sell all the allowances to polluters in an auction. But this bill gives most of them away. Doniger says the allowances are allocated in a way to protect consumers and keep industrial jobs in America. The biggest chunk of allowances will go to electric utilities to avoid big rate increases for customers. Sterba from PNM Power Company says in most states, rates are approved by regulators.
And you can better believe that the regulator is going to ensure that the full value of that goes back to customers.
Some allowances would go to natural gas and heating oil businesses, others to companies like steel mills that use a lot of energy and could lose out to foreign competitors if they increase their prices. Distributing the allowances was crucial to winning enough votes to pass the bill. For example, representatives from the Midwest demanded a share for automakers, and Texas lawmakers insisted on some for oil refiners.
Essentially, it's a political decision, and they're taking political action.
Harvard University economist Robert Staven says that's okay, because a cap-and-trade system will help the environment, whether allowances are sold or given away.
Since the allocation does not affect environmental performance and does not affect the overall cost to the country, then the Congress can and should do what it takes to build the coalition to get sufficient support to put meaningful climate policies in place.
The full House is expected to vote on the bill this summer. President Obama supports the measure, but it's not clear whether there will be enough support in the Senate to get it to his desk. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Todd Gleason in the WILL studios. Next time on the PRI's The World, a young Iranian blogger died in Tehran prisons in March. His death has galvanized a new online movement that promotes free speech and supports bloggers behind bars. The story and the day's news next time on The World coming up at 3 o'clock yet this afternoon, just about 13 and a half minutes away. Right now, Congress has argued over health care for decades, and now they have given themselves a deadline. A little more than a month from now, lawmakers have set an ambitious schedule to try to produce a health care overhaul bill before the next recess, after the one they're taking this weekend. But the next recess is for the 4th of July. NPR's Julie Robner has this update on the progress so far.
Members of the Senate Finance Committee are taking the task of writing a health care overhaul seriously, very seriously. In just the past month, noted Iowa Republican Charles Grassley, they've spent more than 30 hours questioning healthcare experts, staff, and each other over various policy details.
Which is very appropriate for something where we're redirecting 16% of the gross national product.
The committee's ever-upbeat chairman, Montana Democrat Max Baucus, insists that the panel is still well-positioned to meet the ambitious schedule he and Grassley laid out weeks ago.
We planned some time ago that our markup would be mid-June. It's going to be mid-June. We've not let anything slip.
But while senators have insisted that no decisions have been made, some of the areas of disagreement are becoming clearer. A big one is whether people will be allowed to choose between private insurance coverage and some sort of government-funded plan like Medicare. Democrats say a public plan is needed to keep private insurers honest. But Republicans like Orrin Hatch of Utah remain dead set against the so-called public option.
I'm not super enthusiastic about the insurance industry either. But I know one thing, the private sector industry works a lot better than the government sector industry. And that has been proven true over 200 years of this country.
Another big sticking point is how to pay for what's likely to be a big price tag, something in the neighborhood of $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. One possibility is raising taxes on things that aren't good for you. Alcohol and drinks sweetened with sugar have both been suggested. Such taxes, say health experts, would have the double impact of raising revenue and lowering consumption. But those kinds of taxes are particularly unpopular, says Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden.
I think that when you go to taxing Joe Sixpack on his beer and Joe Jr. on his soda pop, what Americans are going to say is we're already spending $2.5 trillion this year on health care. Can't you find some savings out of that enormous sum before you start hitting us with more of these taxes?
Meanwhile, despite Chairman Baucus's insistence that everything is on the table, he conceded in a meeting with reporters yesterday that one thing is not: a single-payer plan that would replace all private health insurance with government-financed coverage.
It's not on the table. It's the only thing it's not, because it cannot pass. It just cannot pass. And we can't squander this opportunity. We can't waste capital on something that's just impossible.
Baucus insisted that single-payer backers should be satisfied with what he is trying to pass.
And everybody's going to have health insurance. That's not a bad result. And they'll have quality health insurance. That's not a bad result.
But that result's still a long ways off. Here's what Baucus conceded Wednesday after members spent hours culling through financing options.
The thought is that when we come back after the recess, we're having, boy, a lot more meetings.
Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Well, it's 84 degrees outside the Urbana-Champaign studios of WILL, 40% humidity this afternoon. Are you thinking about what you might do over the weekend, what the weather will be like? Our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser, has this forecast for the two cities, Urbana-Champaign. Tomorrow, intervals of clouds, a bit of sunshine, some afternoon pop-up thunderstorms. The high tomorrow, 84 here, the wind from the northwest to north at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow night, he says, partly cloudy, the low around 60. Sunday, partly sunny, a chance of a shower or thunderstorm late in the day, the high of 78. And Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of few showers and thunderstorms, the low of 60. Monday, mostly cloudy, showers and thunderstorms. On Memorial Day, a high of 77. Speaking of Memorial Day, many people visit the graves of family and friends, maybe even bring some flowers. When a loved one dies, grieving prevents most of us from thinking about the environmental consequences of conventional funerals and burials. But some people are beginning to weigh the environmental cost of caskets, burial vaults, and grave markers. Todd Melby reports on the Green Death Movement.
Amy Weick works at a bank in downtown Chicago. She's also a big-time environmentalist. She bikes to work, doesn't eat meat, recycles, and she composts.
This is my worm bin. It's a rectangular cube, which I keep my worms in that eat my scrap vegetables. And, look at that. Yum. So this is a mix of scrap paper.
The environment is such a big part of Weick's life. She's not only interested in living green, she wants to die green.
We're Americans. I mean, we are wasteful and we consume and we think that we are entitled to everything. So I'm entitled to using up this massive plot of land for the rest of eternity, you know? That's ridiculous thinking, you know what I mean?
So 11 years ago, when she was only 23, Weick wrote her own will and shared it with her mother.
I can read part of it. Okay.
Sure. So what does it say?
Zero products or services from funeral homes are to be utilized.
Instead, Weick prefers her body to be chemically cremated. But that new high-tech process isn't widely available yet. Her second choice is to be composted with worms.
If all efforts have been exhausted, but these two options are not available, please bury me in a green burial ground, location unimportant.
That second option leaves Weick's mother, Linda Williams, confused.
And the second was composted with worms. And when I read it today, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, she composts with worms in her kitchen. I hope she doesn't expect me to put her in the box.
Weick sees lots of unnecessary waste in conventional burial practices. Caskets constructed from wood or metal are used for just a short time and then go right into the ground. Most graveyards require the casket be placed in a concrete burial vault to prevent leaking. But most eventually leak anyway. Grave markers are often made of granite. And cemeteries are often manicured to perfection using fertilizer and riding lawnmowers. Green burial advocates prefer biodegradable caskets or just a shroud. No burial vault, no grave markers, and no landscaping. They prefer natural surroundings. Weick is hoping to live long enough to see a cemetery in her town go green. So far, that's not happened. But one organization is working on it.
I don't think many people really want many aspects of conventional death care. I think they think it's legally required.
That's Joe Sihi. He's head of the Green Burial Council.
Most Americans do not know that you can have a funeral with a viewing without embalming. Most don't know that you can transport a body across state lines without having to embalm it. Most don't know that burial vaults can be avoided, for example, or that you can go into the grave with a shroud or nothing at all.
The council has been busy certifying all kinds of earth-friendly death products, but has been slow to find graveyards willing to ban concrete vaults and minimize traditional landscaping. That leaves Amy Weick wondering if she's going to have to rely on the worms in her compost bin to dispose of her body. For the Environment Report, I'm Todd Melby.
Congress has taken a big step toward regulating the gases behind global warming. Their elaborate plan is called cap and trade. Think of it as musical chairs with a free market twist.
Somebody could sell you their chair if they figured out a way to live without a chair.
Chairs, carbon emissions, and the very serious game of fighting global warming. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Earth and Sky.
Today, diabetics monitoring their blood sugar sometimes have to endure multiple needle pricks every day. But biomedical engineer Heather Clark of Draper Laboratory is developing a less invasive way to measure blood glucose. She describes it as a nanotech tattoo.
What we envision is something very, very small, on the order of a few millimeters, which would be thousands or millions of nanoparticles, certainly.
As with an ordinary tattoo, Clark said, dye would be injected beneath the skin of someone with diabetes, but this tattoo would require only one tiny pinprick. The dye would be made of nanoparticles, microscopic molecules of plastic that would actually change color.
And so when the glucose is low, the particle is yellow and it's fluorescent. And when the glucose is high, the particle is purple. And the fluorescence goes away. And so you can monitor either by color or by fluorescence.
She said diabetics would have to shine a little light on the tattoo to help get a more accurate read on its glow.
Some sort of optical device, no more complicated than the optical mouse on your computer.
Clark added that the tattoo would have to be periodically re-injected because it would shed along with the skin. She hopes to see this technology up and running in 5 to 10 years. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents Champaign-Urbana at its best.
A couple of notes as we head into this Memorial Day weekend. Don't forget to join us Sunday afternoon for a couple of different shows. At one of those for Media Matters with your host, Bob McChesney. That's at 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoons. Every week, Bob talks with someone on the cutting edge of media. This week's Bob's guest is Robert Weisman, editor of the Multinational Monitor and author of Sold Out, How Wall Street and Washington Betrayed America. This program is pre-recorded, so no phone calls will be taken. That's Media Matters, Sunday afternoon at 1, and then Sunday afternoon at 5. Don't forget to stay with us for our live broadcast of Keeping the Faith. Each week, host Steve Shoemaker and his guest include issues of faith.